Welcome to the Angletopia podcast, where we explore British history, travel, and culture. And I am your host, Jonathan Thomas. One of the things we love doing on this podcast is introducing our American listeners to places in Britain they may have never heard of, places that aren't on the obvious tourist trail, but that have history woven into every stone, every beam, and every room. Today's guest is Magnus Birch Throckmorton, and the place he's going to tell us about is Coton Court, a Tudor manor house in Warwickshire that his family has called home for 600 years. 600 years! To put that in perspective, the Throckmorton family moved into Coton Court before Columbus sailed for America. So, and the history doesn't stop there. This is a house that has stood at the heart of some of the most dramatic moments in English history, from the court of Henry VIII to the gunpowder plot of 1605. It has priest holes hidden in its walls, relics of a family that risked everything to keep their Catholic faith alive through decades of persecution. It has portraits, treasures, and gardens that speak to six centuries of survival and continuity. Now, after a period in which the day-to-day running of Coton Court was managed by the National Trust, Magnus and his wife, Imogen, are personally taking the reins, opening the gates themselves, welcoming visitors, and sharing this extraordinary place with the public in a new and more personal way. And I'm happy to say Coton Court officially reopened a few weeks ago in March, and so the new chapter has begun. So Magnus, welcome to the Angletopia podcast, and thank you for taking the time to introduce your home to our American audience.
Thank you very much. We opened less than a month ago, so it's been busy doing it. It's been a really exciting month, actually, of seeing a lot of hard work and everything come to the fore. But yeah, it's been lovely welcoming people into our home and showing them the family history and what we've been doing in the last few months.
Well, let's talk about that history. This is where I grill you on dates and facts, and you hope you get it right. So the Throckmorton family has been at Coton since 1409. That's more than 600 years of unbroken connection of one place. What does that kind of continuity feel like from the inside? Does it feel like a weight, a privilege, or both?
The simple answer is both. Incredibly exciting, quite scary that your ancestors are looking down at you, judging every step of the way. And they've got the lovely portraits as you walk up the stairs, so you can't get away from them and everything. But it's also a huge privilege to be the latest custodian of Coton Court. It's been looked after by many different members of my family. And this is just the next chapter of us looking after it for our two small children, Hector and Isabella.
So you've now taken on the day-to-day running of Coton Court, and you and your wife are raising your own children there. What does it mean to you to be passing this place on to another generation and raising kids in this special place?
Isabella and Hector were probably the most recent children born here in about 300 years, because obviously usually when people inherit, they're in their late 40s, early 50s, but it skipped a generation to go from my grandmother to myself. So my wife and I moved in when I was 30, she was slightly younger. So Isabel and Hector have been born here. So to have the children running around the house, scooting up and down the paths, it's not all fun and games. They are put to work. My daughter's very good at watering on a Saturday. Mainly she waters the paths, not the plants, which is probably a good thing. Otherwise gardeners would tell us off. But actually, no, it's to have that purpose of the two youngsters, that's the thing that really drives both Emmy and I forward for this, because everything we do is looking after it for them.
Well, how amazing it would be to grow up at a place like that with so many hidden rooms and corridors and meeting people from all over the world. That's got to be, can't even imagine what it would be like.
They're young enough at the moment that hide and seek's not a game that they play very well. So when they hide, it's behind the curtains or something like that. Slightly dreading it when they're slightly older and they start playing hide and seek for real. Thankfully, I don't think they'll be able to get down the priest hiding hole, but you never know. Knowing my son, he's pretty keen to do stuff that lots of 18-month-olds don't do.
There'll be months before you find them, right?
Please don't say that. It's actually one of the things that really makes me nervous is when they run off and you think, where on earth have they gone? Oh.
So for our American listeners who are completely new to hearing about Coton Court, can you give us the big picture? What kind of place is it and what makes it so historically significant?
I think the first thing to say is it's still a family home. So it was like the family moved in 1409, as you said earlier, but Coton is still a family home. It is my family's house. We're still around. We're present. It's lived in. And I think that's a really important facet because it keeps it modern day. We're living here. It's still breathing. It's still living. It's still evolving as we talk about. It's not a statue in time, but it's a Tudor house just outside of Stratford-upon-Avon. It used to be four-sided, but one of the sides got burnt down. And my mother and my grandmother redesigned the gardens in 1991. So brought it back to life, and the gardens are now award-winning and really special. But it's a snapshot in history of a family's time through for the last 600 years with lots of different artifacts and relics, and the way the house has been designed, changed, adapted over time. But it really tells the story of one family who've stayed true to being Catholic the whole way through.
And I must say, it's, I always enjoy seeing when these houses are still lived in by the families, because if they're not lived in anymore and they've sort of been left by the family, they feel like mausoleums. They don't feel lived in. They don't feel cozy. But when you see the family still living there, it makes the visit a little more enjoyable, because you know people are living there.
It's modern day pictures of my daughter in her riding her bicycle with her bright pink helmet on. It's photos of our son's christening, our wedding. It's actually just showing that the rooms are still being used. We still use them. We still enjoy using them. But it's incredibly lucky that we're able to welcome people into the house to show them the history and what the family's been through.
So the house dates to the early Tudor period. The Great Gate House was built around 1530 by Sir George Throckmorton during the reign of Henry VIII. Sir George was actually a courtier to Henry VIII, but famously opposed the king's break with Rome and his marriage to Anne Boleyn. That was a dangerous position to take. What do we know about Sir George in that specific moment in history?
We can only go off bits we've been told and bits that have been researched. So I think everything has to be taken with slight degrees of pinches of salt. In all retrospects, he was a little bit of a troublemaker from what I've read up and what I've learned about him. He was someone who was obviously got on very well with the king, because if he didn't, he wouldn't have stayed alive and kept on going with being able to accuse the king when he opposed Anne Boleyn's wedding. He refused because he said it is wrong to have meddled with both mother and sister, and to which the king was to replied it was never with the mother. So he obviously had a nature of an ability to push the boundaries, as it were, and he openly opposed it. He said the marriage to Anne Boleyn, he did attend the coronation and everything. But he only escaped by making a complete, he asked for complete forgiveness from the king and everything like that. The other interesting fact about Sir George was that he had 19 children and 112 grandchildren. Quite a character.
So there's lots of Throckmortons running around.
Yes. Lots of Throckmortons. I think it was 8 sons and 11 daughters in total. And then 112 grandchildren after that, which in those times was a huge number to have survived.
So happens when there's no TV, right?
Yeah, exactly. And cold.
So the Throckmorton family remained staunchly Catholic through the Reformation, a period when practicing Catholicism in England could cost you your freedom or your life. And hidden in the walls of Cosford Court are priest holes, secret chambers built to hide the Catholic clergy. Can you tell us about those? And what was life like for the family during those years of persecution? How did they kind of walk that fine line between, you know, the two sides?
I think walking the line between the two sides doesn't do it justice, because the persecution of the Catholics at that time was huge. And I think for every service that a landowner was not present at, it was a £20 fine and things like that. So they were persecuted hugely. And I think it was one of those times where the more we read about it, the more we learn about it, the more you start to understand why there was such upset and such people were so keen for their faith to keep going, and they weren't being allowed to do this, they weren't being allowed to do that. And I think it was one of those times and where it made the small group of Catholics stronger and stronger together, and they were more and more in support of each other because it was a very small group who remained Catholic throughout that period. The priest hiding holes, we've got one at Coton, which is a double priest hiding hole. It's great fun. I've been down it. It's not the best hidden, if I'm entirely honest. You go to some other places. You go to Harvington Hall, which was another Throckmorton house, which Nicholas Owen, the main priest hole hide maker, was. And he's completely changed the levels of the house. There's seven priest hiding holes there that they know of, but he's moved staircase and everything. Coton's is very much in one of the towers, and it's been done as a double priest hiding hole. So you'd look down and find the first one and think that there was no one there and it was an empty hole, and actually underneath it was another priest hiding hole. So Coton was used. There were Jesuit priests at Coton and everything, but no one we believe has ever found her.
I'm getting claustrophobic just thinking about it. So, and then there's the gunpowder plot of 1605, one of the most dramatic events in English history that's still commemorated, I guess, is the word you could use every November 5th.
Yeah, some people celebrate it, and I think people forget the meaning of it at times, if I'm entirely honest with you, but it's...
We could make the same argument for the 4th of July, but...
Yes, exactly.
And it's a story most Americans may not even know a lot about. So Coton Court was right at the center of it. So can you walk us through the family's connection to the plot and what happened on that famous night?
I'm going to say a couple of things. The Throckmortons weren't at the center of it. They were very much involved, but they were a step out from the main plotters because through marriage and things like that, and we'll get to that. I think if you must do an entire episode on the gunpowder plot, it's such an intricate web of lies, and the stories that come out of it, and conspiracy theories, and was this person a traitor from the beginning, etc., is fantastic. But the Throckmortons were not directly implicated in the gunpowder plot. They were one step away, would be the way of it. So it was the Throckmorton wives who were heavily linked. So Sir Robert Catesby's mother was Anne Throckmorton, who was a half-sister of Thomas, who was living at Coton, who owned Coton at the time. Francis Tresham's mother was Muriel Throckmorton as well. So the Throckmortons were linked, but never necessarily by name. So none of the plotters had a Throckmorton name to it. But the main thing was that Everard Digby rented Coton off Sir Thomas for his family to be at, to hear whether the plot had succeeded or failed. And the story goes that Nicholas Owen, Father Garnet, and Father Tesimond were here with Lady Digby and Anne Vaux and their servants when Thomas Bates, the servant of Sir Robert Catesby, came up to them, or had brought two letters to Lady Digby and Father Garnet, basically saying the plot had failed, we're in trouble. And they were said to be sitting in, we've got a blue drawing room, which is in the gatehouse at the time when it happened, when the news heard that it had failed.
So
we were bystanders and heavily linked, but our name was never one of the main plotters, if that makes sense.
Well, that's good. So you didn't...
Probably the reason we're here today and have managed to keep Coton in the family and things like that.
Well, and apologies, this isn't on my list of questions, but I was reading the next question. I'm like, wait, we got to talk about that. So going beyond the Reformation into the English Civil War era, what was the House's role in the English Civil War? Which side were the Throckmortons on?
So the parliamentarians attacked it in 1642. They occupied it, and the royalists later used it as a... They attempted to retake it. The house was left in a complete ruin by the end of it. It took a few of my previous ancestors to build it back up, to get it going again. But it was used. I think the exact wording is sacked and plundered, leaving it in a state of ruin.
So beyond the Tudor era, the Civil Wars, and then Catholic Emancipation and two World Wars, what are some other chapters of the house's history that you think are really interesting or deserve more attention?
I think one of the things that's never spoken about is the Throckmorton ladies, the women of Caton. They've always been strong-willed, independent, quite powerful. And I think it's one of those things where the saying is the ladies are the ones who maintain and keep these houses going. They're the ones who put their life and soul into it and the characters of it. So there are various things that happen to get the house back, but it's always been a Throckmorton house. It was a house that people was deemed never grand enough for some time. So if they had more land and things like that, they would go to Western Underwood, Buckland and places like that. But they'd return to Caton when times were tough. But I think some of the ladies of Caton are the powerful ones. And I'm talking, some of the ladies at the plotters for the gunpowder plot, but all equally some of the more recent characters. So my grandmother, I think, was one of the first female QCs in the UK. And I think Lady Lillian, by all accounts, was an incredible character who negotiated the current arrangement with the National Trust. And I think sometimes these people are forgotten about in the grand stories. A completely different way, a different answer to what you're expecting. But I think they're important to take fact of and take note of.
Well, and you're so right, because a lot of historical assessments of these places focus on male primogeniture. But that's not the only story that these places have, because there's so much more than that.
Completely. I mean, another quirk was Caton was designated as a safe zone during the Second World War for the Speaker of the House of Commons in case of a German invasion. We don't know a huge amount about it, but we do know that it was put as a house for the Speaker of the House of Commons. So another quirk and fact.
Interesting. So when an American visitor would walk through the gates of Caton for the first time, what do they see? How do you describe it to someone who's never been there?
It's a Tudor house which has been adapted and changed, with a stunning gatehouse with an incredibly lovely looking Cotswold yellow stone that glints in the summer and the sunshine in at dawn and dusk. It's got the old stables and award-winning gardens. But I hope what people will see past that as much as anything else is the family home, the family feel to it, that it's a lived-in home.
So place it for us in the geography of England. Where is Coton Court?
So Coton Court's in the middle of England. We've got a town 5 miles away from us, which is officially the furthest place from any bit of the sea in the country. So considering we're an island, we are bang in the centre of it. We are about half an hour south of Birmingham and about an hour and a half north of London. So we're in the centre of the country, just north of the Cotswolds, east of Wales, in an amazing part of the country. So Shakespeare's country, Stratford-upon-Avon, is 20 minutes to the south of us. So the way I'll always describe it to friends is we're not necessarily close to anywhere, but we're never that far away. So you can get to anywhere within an hour and a half, 2 hours, basically, unless you go up to Scotland or Devon.
So visitors who may be in London or the Cotswolds could easily get there if they just do a little bit of research.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So it's easy to get to.
We get a lot of people coming from the Cotswolds who come up to Stratford and things like that, and then we are 15 minutes, 20 minutes further on. And yeah, we get a lot of people who visit us over up here, as it were.
So other than the house itself, what are some must-see highlights inside the house, the rooms, the objects, the stories you think are most interesting?
I'm going to give you three objects, which I think all have a difference and something special about them. And I'm going to give you one room. So the room I'm going to talk about is the panel dining room, which to me embodies what one of these lovely houses is about. It's got paneling all the way around it. It comes alive when is the tables laid for a meal, whether it's a Christmas, whether it's Easter. The use of the fake candles with the flickering light through it at night. It's just one of the rooms that I think you have to see to appreciate it. And then we are looking at doing some candlelit tour, like over the winter and things like that, so that you get the house through the darkness and everything. And I think the panel dining room with the wood effect just comes alive and is probably my favorite room in the house to use. It's, and you can sit there and just think, what has happened within these walls? What has happened? What conversations have been had? What stories have been told? What scandals have happened? Just, it's one of those rooms that, to me personally, is very evocative and makes you think, and you can just sit and enjoy the company and the laughter and the general chit-chat and just think, what has happened in this room? What are the stories to be told? Who's had their dinners here? Who's had their suppers here? What's been going on? And just, to me personally, that is one of the highlights and is fantastic. But to me, the other items I was talking about was, we've got a chemise that is believed to have been worn by Mary, Queen of Scots, and they, at the time of her beheading, they think of this because on the, there's a Latin inscription on it saying Mary, Queen of Scots, at her execution on the 8th of February, 1587. And she was an incredibly tall lady. So actually, for those times, it's a very long chemise and everything. So I think that's a really interesting Catholic piece, as it were, which is pretty special. In the same room, we have a cape that we believe Catherine of Aragon used and her ladies-in-waiting worked on. So it's got the pomegranate on the back of it, and the needlework is incredibly fine and delicate and intrinsic. So I think if you look down the Catholic artifacts and things like that, I think those are the two items that, to me, jump out. And then being a boy, it was a bet in 1811 between Sir John Throckmorton and his mill owner that he would be able to shear two sheep and wear a coat between the hours of sunrise and sunset. And it was a 1,000 guinea bet. So they shorn and sheared the sheep, they wove it, they dyed it, and it was worn that evening at the feast to win the bet. And I love the idea of the grandeur of the bet, the scale of the bet on something so minor. But I think the biggest travesty was the two sheep that were shorn were served at the banquet that evening. So for me, it's not going to be the best. It's not going to be the grandest thing in the house. It's not going to be probably something that necessarily catches someone's attention. But I love the story behind it. I love the idea. They tried to recreate it here and they failed miserably, which was a real shame because I was hoping they were going to make me a coat that would fit, that I could wear, but sadly it didn't survive and didn't make it quite so far. The old skills and the old techniques aren't there any longer.
Hopefully you didn't eat the sheep that time. So the gardens at Cochin are award-winning. Your grandmother designed them in the 90s and your mother continued developing them. So tell us about the gardens and what makes them so special.
In gardening terms, they're an incredibly young garden. My mother designed them for my grandmother, effectively, in 1991 when she inherited. And one of the problems that we had was, or I say we, the very royal we, I was four at the time, probably carrying pots, if I, like little plastic pots, was that it had been cut and derelict. So my mum recreated the wall garden and we took out 22 skip loads of rubbish out of it. And she wanted a garden that fitted in with the surroundings and the grandeur of Cochin. So she wanted the formal Tudor knot garden in the courtyard, going to the formal lawn and then just opening up into the vista of the countryside behind. So if you stand at the back of the gatehouse, you have this formal, then semi-formal, and then the wider landscape just opens up in front of you. Because Cochin didn't have that. So she built that into it. And then she has gone around creating the within the wall garden, this really special rose labyrinth, which a traditional English rose garden is just planted with roses, whereas my grandmother and my mother wanted to have perennials and biennials within it. So it's a bit of chaos. You're taken on it's a labyrinth, so there are dead ends. You don't necessarily get to where you're meaning to go to. And it's all designed just to slow the person down to appreciate the colours, the smells, what's going on about it. And it's somewhere that I've fallen in love with, if I'm honest. It's the most magical thing. And it's constantly being adapted, evolved, tweaked, changed. We created the Ladies' Garden not that long ago, which it sits opposite the lake from the Gentleman's Walk. So it's a work in progress. And the really exciting factor is my wife is now taking on more and more of the day-to-day management of the gardens. And you're starting to see her input and her colour choices going into it.
So what else is on the property other than the house and the garden? Are there churches as well? And what's the history of those?
So the property these days, we've got the house, the stable yard, two churches, a lake, and the gardens. The reason for having the two churches is the original church has been seen in the Domesday Book and everything, but obviously was taken from the family during the persecutions. So the family afterwards built the Catholic church at the end of the drive. So we have two different churches on site, which is an interesting quirk and quite interesting. I have ancestors buried in both churches, which always confuses people when they say, you're Catholic, why are there people buried in the Protestant church? And you said, well, it was Catholic and it is now no longer Catholic. So we like to keep people on their toes here at Caton.
So then is one of them still Catholic and one of them still Protestant?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So the one closest to the house is Protestant and the one slightly further away is Catholic.
Well, that's inconvenient on Sunday.
It is. It's quite good for getting in your 10,000 steps though and making sure that you hit that goal and that target.
I just think it's amusing. You're in your house and you hear an Anglican service. You're like, I don't hear it. I don't want to hear it. Nope.
Well, it's very nice when the church bells ring and things like that. And it's a lovely quirk of Caton actually. And both churches are beautiful in their own right, and they have their own quirks and interests within them. The stained glass in the Catholic church is really special.
So let's talk more about you taking over the management of the house. Coton Court reopened last month under your direct management, and this is a big new chapter for the house. So what does it mean to you personally to open the doors and welcome visitors and yourself?
It's almost taking it back 20 years when my grandmother was in charge of opening the doors to the public. And for me, it's always been about honouring what she used to do, how she used to do it, but also bringing Coton into the 21st century with it. It's fresh flowers around the house. It's telling the family stories. I've always said that Coton is a lived-in family house. And for us, it's building a community hub. It's putting Coton back on the map and supporting local artists, local sculptures. I think one of the things that is happening in the world is everywhere is being squeezed and the community aspect never more so. So actually, if we can have somewhere that can bring people together, doesn't matter from where or how, then that's a really important aspect of us opening Coton and what we want to try and achieve, and to use it to support other fantastic organizations. We've got a Dementia Awareness Day coming up later, early next month. And I think it's really important to be able to get people out into open space where they can benefit from the fresh air, they can benefit from the outdoors. And it's being able to do small projects like that I think are really important.
So what are some new features you've introduced to the house? I believe it's a new cafe, there's a new shop of local produce, a charity bookshop. What have these been like on your dream things to do if you took over management?
I think Imi and I have an attitude that we'll try lots of things once and see how it goes. And we are listening to lots of different people's ideas about it. But with the cafe, I was really keen to support local producers. So our tea importer is 15 minutes away from us. Our coffee roasters is 20 minutes away, and build a hub that works locally for everyone. So the cafe, we've gone down the seasonal local route for it. And actually, we're finding that people are just popping in for a coffee, popping in for a dog walk and everything like that. But then we've put in a whole series of workshops, from willow weaving to lino cutting to, we've got a botanical pottery class coming up in a couple of weeks. We've got three potters moving into the old stables. We've got Tai Chi and yoga that happen outside and in the coach house, and just trying to create a little bit of a buzz around the place, as well as supporting. We are opening for two sets of artists to come and exhibit their works for two weeks at a time, to a rose exhibition. We've sort of said we'll try lots of different things, and we'll see what works and what doesn't work. I'm really excited. We're going into partnership. Well, not partnership, that sounds, but we're talking with a local chef about having a once a month supper club. And the trouble is, every menu he sends across gets me salivating and thinking, that sounds absolutely incredible. So I'm thinking one a week, but apparently it's one a month is enough and things like that. But it's just trying to create a space for people to come and enjoy the outside, enjoy the history of the house, learn a bit, but also just stop, slow down and wonder.
And that's what I love watching about these, the modern generation taking on these special places, is it's a fun type of entrepreneurship to watch, trying to see what works, trying to see what people want to see and how people want to enjoy the house, because it becomes, these houses have always been economic magnets for the local communities. So it's nice to see them still doing that.
And I think it's really important that they are still the hub. So we're hosting the Village Fete on the 1st of August, where we're going to have the old traditional sports days. We're going to have the old egg and spoon race. We're going to have three-legged race. We had a traditional Easter trail around the garden, which had games like welly wangy and wheelbarrow racing. So I think being that hub of it, as well as doing, we have a village picnic and things like that, are really important aspects of keeping these places alive, because without their input and without the input of, we've got some amazing volunteers who give up their time to help us here, and who will take people through journeys in the history of the family, who can tell you every portrait, every miniature. Without these people who've put in their love and care for Coton, we wouldn't be able to give anywhere near as good as experience we hope to give people.
So Coton has joined the Historic Houses membership scheme. What does that, which gives members access to hundreds of independent stately homes and heritage properties across Britain. So what does being part of that network mean for the estate now?
So for us, it was a very simple network to join. They've been absolutely incredible with the behind the scenes. What till system to use? What do you do about this? What salvage course do you go on? So as someone who's running one of these houses, the network they can put you in touch with, it has been incredible. And then it all has also opened us up to where we've been nominated for the Historic House Garden of the Year Award this year and everything. And it brings in people who are interested in these historic houses, and they're interested in not being the same. So every house has its own story. Every house has its own tale. Every house will be run slightly differently, because somebody might be a keen gardener, somebody might be a keen historian. I went to go and see Doddington Hall in Lincolnshire, and he's got the largest collection of military uniforms in the world. So each of these houses have their own USPs, as it were, and it's how we harness those collectively together to take people on these journeys and tell the stories of these wonderful places.
I love that. And what is Coton's USP? What are you guys going to focus on compared to other stately home attractions as attractions? Is it the Tudor history? Is it the Catholic history? Is it the gardens?
I think probably a large part of it, I think you fall into three categories. I think the gardens will always draw people back because they're constantly evolving throughout the year. So you can come to the gardens 12 times once a month and you'll see something different in the gardens. But I also think the fact that it's been one family for 600 years with one faith is a really strong, powerful narrative, actually.
It really is. And it roots it in the landscape, the culture, and the history. You've got like the trifecta there. So
and the grey hairs and the energy, hopefully, to drive it forward.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, when you were listing off all the things you guys are doing, I'm like, how do you guys have the energy to do all those things?
Because it's a labor of love. Everything we do.
Lots of coffee, right?
Lots of coffee. But it's also, we're doing it for our children. And it sounds a really silly quibble, but actually having them running around, having them being part of it, them seeing that the hard work we're doing is going places and things like that is really important. And my wife and I work together really well. We delegate. She does the gardens because I'm not allowed near any flowers whatsoever because I'll probably kill them. I'm allowed to use the lawnmower occasionally and things like that. But we're very early into this new stage of Coton's history and we are still finding our feet, but we have a wonderful team behind us and we've got a wonderful set of volunteers who are brilliant, if I'm entirely honest.
So thinking of American visitors, and that's why you're on the podcast, help spread the word to Americans who are our primary audience. Why should American Anglophiles put Coton on their itinerary? What will they get out of there that they won't find at somewhere else? You know, how do you get us Americans to come there?
I think it's important to remember that there's a lot of Throckmortons over in America. So John Throckmorton went over there. We've got strong roots over there anyway, as we speak. And the Throckmorton daffodil was developed over in America and everything. I think what does Coton brings a unique modern day approach to running one of these places. You will see either Emmy and I on the welcome hut. You'll see us taking tours. You will see us. This morning I was pot washing in the kitchen. I think some people come to the UK expecting these houses to be the new Downton Abbey. And when people come and stay with us and we have people who come and have private lunches with us and everything, we say, absolutely, we'll be your Carsons, we'll be your Aunt. We do everything. There is no grandeur here. This is a living and breathing family house. We've taken a very hands-on approach to it.
So Coton sits right in the heart of Shakespeare country. Stratford-upon-Avon is nearby. The Cotswolds are within easy reach. How do you think it fits into the broader Midlands itinerary for an American visitor? Because for most Americans, the Midlands aren't usually on their default itineraries for Britain. The American geography of Britain is London, Cotswolds, maybe Yorkshire, Scotland. And yeah. And maybe like Cornwall, but they tend to focus on these core areas. So how do you get them to get out of the Cotswolds and come to Warwickshire?
I would say we're 20 minutes out of the Cotswolds, so we're not far from a lot of the very nice hotels in the Cotswolds and everything like that. And actually, the one of the really exciting things about Coton is it's not just a house, it's not just a garden. We're having people spending all day here at the moment, exploring the family history, exploring the house, going for a guided tour in the morning, going around the gardens and coming back to the house. So there is a full day's activity to do if you want, or you can do it within a few hours. But actually what we're finding, and we've only been open a month, so we are still very new to this, so is that people are coming and enjoying and taking the time to. It's not just a stop off. We're able to entice people and encourage people to spend a bit longer here. So it's becoming a bit more of a destination for people to come. We have the support of a few Americans who already come to us and they've all seemed to have fallen in love with the personal side of their trip and everything. And to be meeting both Emmy and I and we had a group of American ladies who came and all they were interested in was but they wanted to see what our daughter's bedroom was like and things like that. And it's we're happy to take people behind the scenes to show them that actually we are a very we're normal family living here. We've got two children who are the world to us, but we'll take you on our family history and we'll take you on our story. You won't have, you'll probably have more historical trips and tours. You'll probably have more garden knowledge of it, but we will give you an insight into what it is like living at Coton and a day-to-day, a day in the life of Magnus and Imogen at Coton, I suppose, is the snapshot of what people see.
Well, I'm sold, so I'm going to have to come visit. So what can visitors look forward to this summer? What major events do you have going on, or what do you got planned?
So we've got a summer packed full of different things. We've mentioned all the workshops. We've got the walled garden and the gardens come into their own end of May, early June, where the roses are particularly starting to flower and to come out. And that's always been one of our most special times of the year. But then you go through into late July and August and the long herbaceous borders. So we've got a lovely long cold hot border going up one side and then a cool border coming down. But then we've got Lord Chamberlain's men doing their play Othello on the back lawn. We've got a local theatre production doing some more children's based stuff. We are just opening up the doors at the moment and seeing what people enjoy. But actually the best thing to come and do is enjoy one of the fantastic ice creams we have.
Again, I'm sold. So, well, what a wonderful conversation this has been and what a remarkable place Coton Court is. Thank you so much for joining us on the Angletopia podcast, Magnus, and for helping introduce your special home to our American listeners. Coton Court is open Wednesday through Sunday, 9 to 4:30 p.m., and you can find out all the details, including tickets and upcoming events, at the website, which we will link to in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, like, or comment. And if you like the Angletopia podcast, please consider joining the Friends of Angletopia Club, where you can get early access to new episodes and connect with other enthusiasts about Britain. Join us next time as we continue exploring the people, places, and stories that make Britain's cultural heritage so endlessly fascinating to discover. Thank you again, Magnus.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and really nice to meet you.